Hello, this is Rachel Durkin Durga, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the 10th of December issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Snowfall warning live, messy commute to start the day, flights delayed at Pearson, and some school boards canceling buses as heavy snow falls. By Maya Tustonic. Environment Canada has issued a snowfall warning due to forecasted heavy snow on Wednesday. Between 5 to 10 centimeters of snow are expected to fall, which could reduce visibility throughout the day, the statement said. The storm is expected to be heavy in the morning and then taper off to scattered flurries or drizzle this afternoon. Residents near the Lake Ontario shore will likely see less snow and either more rain or a mix of rain and snow. Travel during the storm will likely be challenging, the agency said. Accumulating snow will make roads and walkways more difficult to navigate, and rush hour traffic will face a, quote, significant impact, end quote. Quote, prepare for quickly changing and deteriorating travel conditions, the agency said. Allow extra time for travel. What is an Alberta Clipper? By Daisha Loppy. A clipper is the name of fast-moving storms that can form inland in Alberta as a low-pressure system moves southeast through Canada towards the Great Lakes before wandering off into the Atlantic Ocean. Warm, moist winds from the Pacific Ocean blow over Canada's western mountains, and when they hit the cold winter air in the prairies, a storm is created that moves south until it's propelled towards the U.S. Midwest by a jet stream. Alberta clippers usually happen from December through February and are known for plunging temperatures, quick bursts of snow, usually up to about 10 centimeters, and fast wind. The name clipper comes from the fast-moving ships of the 19th century that were built for speed instead of cargo capacity to transport valuable items like tea and spices. Wednesday's Alberta clipper will affect certain parts of Ontario, including the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area, according to Environment Canada, which also reports that Toronto can expect about 5 to 10 centimeters of snow, with winds possibly reaching 50 kilometers per hour. A yellow snowfall warning was issued for Toronto, meaning the impact level on the city will be moderate. Doctors are alarmed by the flu season's early arrival in Toronto, which is hitting children the hardest. By Sadine Mosen. It's an annual misery, the deluge of sick, feverish kids arriving at ERs across Toronto. Only this year, influenza season has come earlier, and it's nastier. Children are flooding Toronto hospitals, pediatricians across the city are concerned about crowded emergency departments, and experts say this is all likely being driven by a mutated form of the virus. Dr. Kim Zhu, Chief of Pediatrics at North York General Hospital, is pointing the finger at H3N2, a new mutated strain of influenza A, as a possible cause. The strain tends to cause more severe infections and has been called a possible, quote, mismatch, end quote, for this year's flu vaccine, though doctors say it would still provide protection against the mutation. Between November 1st and December 4th, North York General said there were 652 emergency department visits for patients under 18. The hospital is currently seeing 120 to 140% of capacity within its pediatric unit, which is unusual for this time of year. Zhao said she's been seeing most children come in with, quote, really high fevers, coughing, vomiting, diarrhea, and dehydration. I don't think we understand yet why the flu season is hitting a bit earlier this year, but we do know that the particular strain of influenza A we're seeing, H3N2, does affect young children and the elderly more, end quote. Doctors begin to see the influenza B virus, which leads to severe infections in children, whereas influenza A is more severe in adults, spread in January, Zhao said, which might lead to a, quote, challenging year for flu in pediatrics. We're certainly concerned if this continues to increase at the rate it's currently rising, end quote. Dr. Michelle Murty, the medical officer of health at Toronto Public Health, said Toronto is, quote, about a month ahead, maybe more, end quote, in flu activity this year compared to 2024. Murty said children under 5 are accounting for higher rates of flu hospitalizations than adults over 80, with both groups being vulnerable. When patients aged 5 to 19 test for influenza, they're almost 50% positive. Quote, if they're sick, it's very likely that they are ill with the flu just because of how much more they're getting affected by it, end quote. Sarah War, a spokesperson for the Hospital for Sick Children, said it is seeing more, quote, positive flu tests, end quote, this year compared to the same period in 2024, with this season starting earlier. This rise also contributed to an increase in emergency department visits, which grew by 50% in the past 2 weeks. Quote, patients and families with non-emergent medical issues should expect longer than usual wait times, end quote, she said in a statement to the Star. This trend is not limited to Toronto. Last week, CHEO, a children's hospital based in Ottawa, said it saw a concerning rise in flu cases and hospitalizations. Quote, hospitals are really busy already for other reasons, so anything we can be doing now to help protect people heading into that holiday season is really important, end quote, Murty said, urging people to get vaccinated as early as possible. On December 5th, Toronto Public Health issued a notice to physicians to, quote, expedite flu vaccination for their patients this week, end quote, due to increases in influenza activity, as per the Chief Medical Officer of Health of Ontario. Dr. Jeff Powis, head of infectious diseases at Michael Garron Hospital, is also seeing an influx of children coming in with the flu. Quote, we saw record numbers of young people presenting, end quote, to the ER. Powis is expecting to see a rough year for the flu with the addition of the H3N2 strain and numbers well above the peak number of cases in previous flu seasons. Quote, the vaccine isn't quite as effective covering this strain as we would have hoped it to be, end quote. Prevention measures will be the same advice doctors gave during the COVID-19 pandemic, he said, including practicing proper hand hygiene and avoiding illness exposures. Quote, it's going to be a busy flu season, and we're preparing for that, end quote. Canada's ambassador to U.S., Kirsten Hillman, quits unexpectedly as trade talks falter, by Tonda McCharles. Canada's powerhouse ambassador to Washington, Kirsten Hillman, is stepping down in a surprise resignation as critical trade negotiations have stalled and the U.S. is toying with letting the Continental Free Trade Pact expire. In a public statement posted late Tuesday, Hillman did not reveal the reason she is leaving in the new year, but she previously had been expected to stay on for a full year through next year's review of the Canada-U.S.-Mexico agreement. President Donald Trump is eyeing that review as a means to extract more trade concessions from Canada, wielding tariffs as a tool of, quote, economic force, end quote, and mused last week he may simply let it expire. Hillman had in fact been named mere months ago to lead the sensitive trade negotiations, along with Canada-U.S. Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc. Quote, I spoke to the Prime Minister about this, and I said it's time for me to start a new chapter. He had asked me back in the spring to stay on for the transition of his government and the transition to the new Trump administration, end quote, Hillman told CTV News anchor Omar Sashadina. Quote, I agreed to do that, and I'm honored to have done that, end quote. She was by Prime Minister Mark Carney's side in a VIP box on Friday as the leaders and Mexico President Claudia Sheinbaum met in Washington at the World Cup soccer tournament draw. The leaders met later without staff for 45 minutes with no real public report of the outcome, other than the three countries would continue to work on the trade deal's review. quote, "It has been the greatest privilege of my professional life to have served and represented Canada and Canadians during this critical period in Canada-U.S. relations," end quote, Hillman wrote. After Carney won elections, names floated around in the Ottawa bubble for who might become the former central banker's envoy in D.C., but Hillman was pegged to stay on. For months, the names of former Quebec Premier Jean Charest and financier Mark Wiseman, a former Canada Pension Plan Investment Board director, were tossed around. On Tuesday, one source told the Star's Althea Raj that Wiseman is the choice, while a senior government official would say only that Wiseman's name is in play and that no one is locked in for the posting. Hillman was a key and effective player for Canada and Washington, and praise for her service quickly poured in. Peter Hoekstra, Trump's ambassador in Canada and Hillman's diplomatic counterpart, posted on X, quote, "Kirsten, you have been an awesome and well-respected contributor to the U.S.-Canada relationship. I value your friendship and wish you all the best in your next adventure. You will be missed," end quote. Flavio Volpe, head of Canadian Auto Parts Manufacturers Association, lauded her in a post on X as a, quote, "dignified, thoughtful, and skilled chief representative of Team Canada," end quote. Over the past 8 years, Hillman assembled a famous Rolodex of contacts in Washington and state legislatures, with connections in both Republican and Democratic political circles. She steered Canada's response to the Trump administration and its aggressively protectionist second term, frequently traveling back to Ottawa to brief cabinet or parliamentary committees. A lawyer by training and one of the lead trade negotiators of the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership that Canada joined, Hillman has been posted to Washington since 2017 and appointed ambassador by then Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in 2020 to replace David McNaughton. She helped lead the NAFTA renegotiation in Trump's first term, which led to the current agreement known as CUSMA, the very deal Trump now threatens to let expire or renegotiate. In her public resignation statement, Hillman said she will stay on to help her successor make the transition, just as McNaughton had helped her. Hillman did not indicate what she plans to do next. In a statement posted to X, Carney hailed her, quote, "intelligence, determined action, and diplomacy," end quote, as having, quote, "contributed immensely to the advancement of a new economic and security relationship with the United States and prepared the foundations for Canada in the upcoming review of CUSMA," end quote. Carney also praised Hillman for wide-ranging and constructive engagement with all branches of the U.S. government, quote, "as well as with leaders across America and Canada that have yielded crucial results for Canadians." Former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called Hillman a real patriot. Quote, "My first meeting with Kirsten was on my first official trip as Prime Minister, mere weeks after being elected, as she briefed me in the Philippines on the complexities and opportunities of our trade with Asia. Her skill, toughness, and commitment to her country shone through from the very beginning," end quote, Trudeau said, adding that after navigating through Canada's negotiation of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, helping renegotiate NAFTA, and getting steel and aluminum tariffs lifted by Washington, quote, "Kirsten earned her place as ambassador to the United States," end quote. He added she, quote, "quietly and effectively contributed to the release of Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor," end quote, the two Canadians imprisoned by China after Canada acceded to a U.S. arrest warrant request for a Chinese executive. Hillman said of all the consequential issues she confronted in Washington, quote, "none was more personal to me than the hundreds of hours I spent with U.S. and Chinese counterparts working for the release of Kovrig and Spavor," end quote. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Georgia Democrat Eric Gissler claims upset state House win in historically Republican district. By the Associated Press. Democrat Eric Gissler claimed an upset victory Tuesday in a special election in a historically Republican Georgia State House district. Gissler said he was the winner of the contest, in which he was leading Republican Mac Dutch Guest by about 200 votes out of more than 11,000 in final unofficial returns. Robert Sinners, a spokesperson with the Secretary of State's office, said there could be a few provisional ballots left before the tally is finalized. Quote, "I think we had the right message for the time," end quote, Gissler told the Associated Press in a phone interview. He credited his win to Democratic enthusiasm, but also said some Republicans were looking for a change. Quote, "A lot of what I would call traditional conservatives held their nose and voted Republican last year on the promise of low prices and whatever else they were selling, but they hadn't received that," end quote. Guest did not immediately respond to a text message seeking comment late Tuesday. Democrats have seen a number of electoral successes in 2025, as the party's voters have been eager to express dissatisfaction with Republican President Donald Trump. In Georgia in November, they romped to two blowouts in statewide special elections for the Public Service Commission, unseating two incumbent Republicans in campaigns driven by discontent over rising electricity costs. Nationwide, Democrats won governor's races by broad margins in Virginia and New Jersey. On Tuesday, a Democrat defeated a Trump-endorsed Republican in the officially nonpartisan race for Miami mayor, becoming the first from his party to win the post in nearly 30 years. Democrats have also performed strongly in some races they lost, such as a Tennessee U.S. House race last week and a Georgia State Senate race in September. Republicans remain firmly in control of the Georgia House, but their majority is likely to fall to 99 to 81 when lawmakers return in January. Also, Tuesday, voters in a second heavily Republican district in Atlanta's northwest suburbs sent Republican Bill Fincher and Democrat Scott Sanders to a January 6th runoff to fill a vacancy created when Representative Mandy Ballinger died. The GOP majority is down from 119 Republicans in 2015. It would be the first time the GOP holds fewer than 100 seats in the lower chamber since 2005, when they won control for the first time since Reconstruction. The race between Gissler and Guest in House District 121 in the Athens area, northeast of Atlanta, was held to replace Republican Marcus Wiedauer, who was in the seat since 2018, but resigned in the middle of his term to focus on business interests. Most of the district is in Oconee County, a Republican suburb of Athens, reaching into heavily Democratic Athens-Clark County. Republicans gerrymandered Athens-Clark to include one strongly Democratic district, parceling out the rest of the county into three seats intended to be Republican. Gissler ran against Wiedauer in 2024, losing 61% to 39%. This was Guest's first time running for office. A Democrat briefly won control of the district in a 2017 special election, but lost to Wiedauer in 2018. Gissler, a 49-year-old Watkinsville resident, works for an insurance technology company and owns a gourmet olive oil store. He campaigned on improving health care, increasing affordability, and reinvesting Georgia's surplus funds. Guest is the president of a trucking company and touted his community ties, promising to improve public safety and cut taxes. He was endorsed by Republican Governor Brian Kemp, an Athens native, and raised far more in campaign contributions than Gissler. Two Democrats, two strategies. Texas Senate race shows party split on Trump focus in midterm elections, by Joey Cappelletti and Thomas Beaumont. A Dallas congresswoman opened her Senate campaign by telling voters that she, quote, has gone toe-to-toe with Donald Trump, end quote. Her Democratic primary opponent insisted that Americans are tired of, quote, politics as a blood sport, end quote. The divergent approach highlights how U.S. Representative Jasmine Crockett and State Representative James Tallarico are navigating a race where Democrats hope to break a three-decade losing streak in Texas. It also reflects a broader divide within the party, with some candidates continuing to focus on Trump while others barely mention his name. Figuring out the best approach will be critical for Democrats who are grasping for a path back to power in the 2026 midterm elections that will determine control of Congress and are already maneuvering for the 2028 presidential race. Susie Wiles, the White House Chief of Staff, said in a recent podcast interview that the Republican president will campaign aggressively next year and the party, quote, will put him on the ballot, end quote. Quote, he is the greatest vote energizer in the history of politics, said Neil Newhouse, a veteran Republican pollster. But the challenge is that he does it as much for Democrats as he does for Republicans, end quote. In her campaign launch video, Crockett was silent as audio of Trump's insults played, including multiple times that he has called her a, quote, very low IQ person, end quote. At the end of the video, she breaks out into a smile. On Monday, she addressed the president more directly. Quote, Trump, I know you're watching, so let me tell you directly, Crockett said. You're not entitled to a damn thing in Texas. You better get to work because I'm coming for you, end quote. Trump responded the next day, telling reporters aboard Air Force One that her candidacy is, quote, a gift to Republicans, end quote, and, quote, I can't even believe she's a politician, actually, end quote. For nearly a decade, Democrats have used their criticism of Trump to draw attention and fuel fundraising. Governors who are considered potential 2028 presidential contenders, including California's Gavin Newsom and Illinois' J.B. Pritzker, saw their profiles rise as they positioned themselves as staunch Trump opponents. U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, recently participated in a video telling service members that they should not follow, quote, illegal orders, end quote. Trump responded by accusing him of, quote, seditious behavior, end quote, that's, quote, punishable by death, end quote. Kelly started a national media tour and sent out a flurry of fundraising emails, both for himself and other Democrats. He said Trump has bullied everyone in his career, quote, but not now, because I won't let it happen, end quote. When it comes to running for office, quote, Trump is the red meat that drives donors, end quote, said John Anzalone, a longtime Democratic pollster. Quote, there are clearly some candidates that are playing towards the donor world that don't actually make a great argument for winning races, but it's great for clicks and making money, and money is the first primary that you need to win, end quote. Tallarico has built a following with a less combative style. The former school teacher, who is working toward a master's degree in divinity at Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary, gained attention by posting viral social media content challenging Republicans' claims to Christian values. He has focused less on Trump or other politicians. Quote, the biggest divide in our country is not left versus right. It's top versus bottom, end quote, Tallarico said in the video launching his campaign. There are echoes of other Democratic successes this year, such as when candidates for governor won in New Jersey and Virginia by focusing on affordability concerns. Mike Sherrill, the incoming New Jersey governor, said recently that Trump motivates his critics to vote, but it is not enough for Democrats to rely solely on anti-Trump fervor. Quote, Trump makes a difference. He's a forcing mechanism to coalesce the party, Sherrill said. But to really turn out the vote in a really strong manner, you have got to run a really sharp campaign, end quote. When Democrats talk about Trump, they have to connect his actions to voters' everyday lives. Quote, you can't just say, oh, I'm so upset that Trump demolished the East Wing of the White House, end quote, she said. Quote, you have to say, look, there's a tariff regime that is being run that is enriching the president to the tune of $3 billion, and you're paying more for everything from your cup of coffee in the morning to the groceries that you're buying to cook for your family dinner at night, end quote. It's an approach that could have more staying power in the coming years. Quote, in the not-too-distant future, Trump will not be on the ballot, and that will be a challenge for both parties, end quote, said Austin Cook, a senior aide for Democrat Eliza Slotkin's successful U.S. Senate campaign in Michigan last year. Quote, he is a starting gun for Democratic enthusiasm, but soon we won't have him as a foil, end quote. Republicans have little choice but to enlist Trump's help, considering his enduring support among voters who were less likely to turn out during the midterms. Quote, they need to energize Republican voters, and the only real way to energize Republican voters and get them out to vote is by enlisting Trump in the campaign, end quote, said Newhouse, who is advising some of the party's U.S. Senate candidates. He warned that Trump's popularity does not necessarily transfer to candidates he supports. Quote, but there isn't an alternative. What they are trying to do here is basically wrap themselves up in him, hope that his approval and the economic numbers improve, and get their voters out to the polls to match the Democrats' intensity, end quote, Newhouse said. The White House has said that Trump will be on the road more in the coming months. He hosted his first rally in a while in Pennsylvania on Tuesday evening, where he blamed Democrats for inflation. Quote, they gave you high prices, he said, adding that, quote, we're bringing those prices down rapidly, end quote. Hegseth tells congressional leaders he is weighing release of boat strike video by the Associated Press. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is facing intensifying demands from Congress to release the full video of an attack on an alleged drug boat that killed two survivors in what Democrats and legal experts said may have been a war crime or murder. Hegseth provided a classified briefing for congressional leaders Tuesday alongside Secretary of State Marco Rubio and CIA Director John Ratcliffe at the Capitol. He said he's still weighing whether to release the video. The situation has awakened the Republican-controlled Congress to its oversight role after months of frustration about the trickle of information from the Pentagon. Meanwhile, the U.S. military flew a pair of fighter jets over the Gulf of Venezuela on Tuesday as the Trump administration raises pressure on President Nicolas Maduro. Federal Reserve likely to cut rates as Trump eyes a new chair by the Associated Press. The bigger question for financial markets and the economy is what Chair Jerome Powell may signal Wednesday regarding the central bank's next steps. This would be the third cut in a row and bring the Fed's key rate to about 3.6%, the lowest in nearly 3 years. For Americans struggling with high borrowing costs for homes, cars, and other large purchases, rate cuts could reduce those costs over time, though it's not guaranteed. This week's meeting could presage a much cloudier path ahead. The government shutdown delayed 2 months of jobs and inflation data, leaving the Fed with much less information on hiring and inflation. And with Powell's term as chair ending in May, Trump will nominate a replacement, possibly as soon as this month, who will almost certainly push for lower borrowing costs. Republicans' anxiety about Hispanic voters grows by the Associated Press. Republicans in Florida have found strong support from voters with heritage from Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, as they liken Democratic leaders to the governments they fled. But U.S. Representative Maria Elvira Salazar, a Republican whose district is being targeted by Democrats and includes the city of Miami, said Hispanics also want a secure border, a healthy economy, and some relief for, quote, those who have been here for years and do not have a criminal record, end quote. Quote, the Hispanic vote is not guaranteed, end quote, Salazar said in a video post after Democratic wins in New Jersey and Virginia. Quote, Hispanics married President Trump, but they are only dating the GOP, end quote. Democrat David Jolly, running for Florida governor, celebrated the results in Miami. Quote, change is here. It's sweeping the nation and it's sweeping Florida, end quote. Democrat wins by huge margin over Trump-endorsed candidate for Miami mayor. Voters elected Eileen Higgins by a margin of about 19 percentage points on Tuesday, defeating a Republican endorsed by President Donald Trump to end her party's nearly three-decade losing streak and give Democrats a boost in one of the last electoral battles ahead of the 2026 midterms. Quote, we are facing rhetoric from elected officials that is so dehumanizing and cruel, especially against immigrant populations, end quote, Higgins told the Associated Press after her victory speech in the Hispanic-majority city that may become the home of Trump's presidential library. Quote, the residents of Miami were ready to be done with that, end quote. The victory provides Democrats with some momentum as the GOP looks to keep its grip in Florida. Quote, tonight's result is yet another warning sign to Republicans that voters are fed up with their out-of-touch agenda that is raising costs, end quote, Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin said in a statement. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. North Korea's ruling elite prepares for once-in-5-years party meeting by Hyung Jin Kim. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and other top officials have gathered to discuss preparations for the ruling party's first full Congress in 5 years, the state media reported Wednesday. The top-level meeting will set new priorities as the U.S. and South Korea seek a resumption of talks with North Korea. The Korean Central News Agency reported that Kim presided over a plenary meeting of the Workers' Party's Central Committee on Tuesday. It said participants began discussing unspecified key issues related to the party Congress and reviewing this year's state policies. KCNA gave no further details, but observers say the plenary meeting will likely last a few days and set an official agenda for the party Congress, which is expected to be held in January or February. The Congress, the top decision-making organ of the Workers' Party, was revived by Kim in 2016 after a 36-year hiatus. Experts say Kim aimed to increase the party's authority as part of efforts to solidify his grip on power. The focus of outside attention on the Congress is whether Kim will respond to U.S. and South Korean efforts to improve ties. North Korea has steadfastly rebuffed the U.S. and South Korea's calls to resume talks since Kim's high-stakes nuclear diplomacy with President Donald Trump collapsed in 2019, but some experts say Kim could return to talk with the U.S. next year. In an apparent response to Trump's repeated outreach, Kim suggested in September that he could return to talks if the U.S. drops, quote, its delusional obsession with denuclearization, end quote, of North Korea. Meanwhile, South Korea's military said North Korea fired several artillery rounds off the North's west coast on Tuesday. Observers say the artillery launches were likely part of the North Korean military's wintertime training. Last year, Kim declared that his country was abandoning its long-standing goal of peaceful reunification with South Korea and ordered the rewriting of the North's constitution to mark the South as a permanent enemy. Pope criticizes U.S. bid to break apart U.S.-Europe alliance, insists on Europe role in Ukraine peace, by Nicole Winfield. Pope Leo XIV insisted Tuesday that Europe must have a role in any Ukraine peace deal and criticized what he said was the Trump administration's effort to, quote, break apart, end quote, the long-standing U.S.-European alliance. Leo spoke to reporters after meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who was on another tour to rally European support for Kyiv. The American Pope said they discussed the need for a ceasefire and the Vatican's efforts to facilitate the return of Ukraine children taken by Russian authorities. Leo was asked about the U.S. peace proposal and the seeming sidelining of European powers in the process. Speaking as he left his vacation home in Castel Gandolfo, Leo insisted that Europe's role was crucial to any deal. Quote, seeking a peace agreement without including Europe in the talks is unrealistic given the war is in Europe, he said. Guarantees are also being sought for security today and in the future. Europe must be a part of this, and unfortunately not everyone understands this. But I think there is a great opportunity for European leaders to unite and seek a solution together, end quote. Zelensky has said there are three documents in the peace agreement being discussed with the U.S. and European partners: a framework document of 20 points, a second document with security guarantees, and a third document about Ukraine's recovery. Leah was asked about the U.S. peace plan for Ukraine, but appeared to respond to a broader question about the Trump administration's views on the U.S.-Europe alliance. Just last week, the Trump administration released its U.S. national security strategy, which questions the U.S.-European alliance and stresses a desire to improve U.S.-Russia relations. Leo said what he had read would, quote, make a huge change in what was for many, many years a true alliance between Europe and the United States, end quote. Additionally, some comments by U.S. President Donald Trump suggest an effort, quote, trying to break apart what I think needs to be an alliance today and in the future, end quote. While some people in the United States may agree with that effort, quote, I think many others would see things in a different way, end quote, Leo said. The Holy See has tried to remain neutral in Russia's war while offering solidarity and concrete assistance to what it calls the martyred people of Ukraine. Leo has met now three times with Zelensky and has spoken by telephone at least once with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The American Pope has called for a ceasefire and urged Russia in particular, to make gestures to promote peace. The Vatican has also tried to facilitate the return of Ukrainian children taken by Russian authorities, and last month, Leo met with some returned children at the Vatican. European nations set to discuss a tightening of migration rules by Sam McNeill and Renata Brito. European leaders will call for a toughening of migration policies on Wednesday, in a move critics say bends to pressure from far-right groups and harms basic human rights protections for vulnerable people. Ministers from 27 EU member nations are meeting in Brussels to discuss countering migrant smuggling, with a keynote speech by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. In Strasbourg, France, representatives from the Council of Europe, 46 countries from Iceland to Azerbaijan, are expected to debate making deporting migrants easier for signatories to key treaties. Denmark was part of a nine-nation attempt last year to curtail the power of the European Court of Human Rights, the independent legal arm of the Council of Europe. Austria, Belgium, Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland argue that the court's interpretation of rights obligations prevented them from expelling migrants who commit crimes. That effort ultimately failed, but support for its basic tenets has still grown. The European Court of Human Rights handles complaints against the Council of Europe under the European Convention on Human Rights, including many cases involving migrants and asylum seekers. The intergovernmental organization is not an EU institution and was set up in the wake of World War II to promote peace and democracy. Centrist and left-wing parties across Europe are coalescing around the idea of tougher migration policies as a way to blunt the momentum of far-right politicians exploiting discontent over immigration. The prime ministers of Denmark and the UK published an op-ed in the Guardian newspaper on Tuesday calling for tightening migration controls to deny entry to those seeking better economic opportunities as opposed to fleeing conflict. Quote, for decades, citizens in our countries have demanded action, so we are acting, not to exploit these issues and stoke grievances as some do, but to find real solutions, end quote, wrote Mette Frederiksen and Keir Starmer. Quote, the best way of fighting against the forces of hate and division is to show that mainstream progressive politics can fix this problem, end quote. Illegal border crossings into the EU were down 22% from January to October this year, according to Frontex, the EU's border and coast guard agency. The agency recorded 152,000 unauthorized border crossings in the first 10 months of the year. Most migration to Europe happens legally by air, with some immigrants overstaying tourist visas. The EU has spent billions of euros to deter irregular migration, paying countries in Africa and the Middle East to intercept migrants trying to cross the Mediterranean or the Atlantic. At the same time, European nations facing labor shortages and an aging population are in desperate need of more workers and have been investing in programs to attract and train foreign workers. The Secretary General of the Council of Europe, Hélène Berset, said ahead of the Strasbourg meeting that the European Convention on Human Rights was, quote, the final safeguard of individual rights and freedoms across our continent, end quote. Quote, the convention's future and Europe's directions are inseparable, end quote, he said. Aid flow into Gaza falls short of ceasefire terms, analysis of Israeli figures show, by Julia Frankel. Aid deliveries into Gaza are falling far short of the amount called for under the U.S.-brokered ceasefire, according to an Associated Press analysis of the Israeli military's figures. Under the October ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas, Israel agreed to allow 600 trucks of aid into Gaza each day, but an average of only 459 trucks a day have entered Gaza between October 12th, when flow of the aid restarted, and December 7th, according to an AP analysis of figures by COGAT, the Israeli military body in charge of coordinating aid entry. By all accounts, aid has fallen short in Gaza. COGAT said that roughly 18,000 trucks of food aid had entered Gaza between the ceasefire taking effect and Sunday. It said that figure amounted to 70% of all aid that had entered the territory since the truce. That means COGAT estimates that a total of just over 25,700 trucks of aid have entered Gaza, well under the 33,600 trucks that should have entered by Sunday under the terms of the ceasefire. Throughout the conflict, the UN and aid groups have said the amount of aid entering Gaza is far lower than COGAT claims. The UN says only 6,545 trucks have been offloaded at Gaza crossings between the ceasefire and December 7th, amounting to about 113 trucks a day. That's according to its online database. The UN figures do not include aid trucks sent bilaterally by organizations not working through the UN network. A Hamas document on Saturday provided to the AP put the amount of aid trucks that have entered at 7,333. This week, United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs stressed a, quote, dire, end quote, need for more aid to enter Gaza, saying Israeli restrictions on aid have bottlenecked recovery efforts. Food remains scarce in Gaza, aid groups say. Humanitarian groups say lack of aid has had harsh effects on many of Gaza's 2 million residents, most of whom were forcibly displaced by war. Food remains scarce as the Palestinian territory struggles to bounce back from famine, which hit parts of Gaza during the war. Starving mothers in Gaza are giving birth to malnourished babies, some of whom have died in hospital, according to a recent report by UNICEF. As winter rains pick up, displaced families living in tents have been left exposed to the elements and without supplies to cope with floods and the biting cold. Quote, needs far outpace the humanitarian community's ability to respond, given persistent impediments, end quote, the agency wrote in a report on Monday. Quote, these obstacles include insecurity, customs clearance challenges, delays and denials of cargo at the crossings, and limited routes available for transporting humanitarian supplies within Gaza, end quote. Israel temporarily stopped all aid entry at least once in response to alleged Hamas violations of the truce. Israel said that Hamas has failed to return the bodies of the hostages in the time period established by the ceasefire, while Hamas has said it struggled to find the bodies due to the destruction left by Israel in the Palestinian territory. Hamas has also accused Israel of violating the ceasefire terms because of the slow flow of aid, continued closure of the Rafah crossing, and ongoing deadly strikes on Gaza. Meanwhile, Israel says it is demanding the return of the final hostage, Ron Gvili. The office of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the AP on Wednesday that Gvili's remains must be returned, a condition of the first phase of the ceasefire. Quote, once phase one is completed, phase two will begin, end quote, the office said in a statement. Hamas militants and Red Cross crews continued to comb the ruins of Gaza City for the final body this week, while the militant group Islamic Jihad claimed it had handed over the last hostage body in its possession. On Tuesday, Hamas called for more international pressure on Israel to open key border crossings, cease deadly strikes on the territory, and allow more aid into the Strip. The accusations mark the latest road bump at what regional leaders have described as a critical time for the ceasefire agreement, as mediators seek to push the truce into its second, more complicated phase. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Health Canada approves first pill to treat postpartum depression, by Nicole Ireland. Health Canada has approved the first drug designed to treat postpartum depression. Zuranolone, sold under the brand name Zurzuvae, is a pill taken once a day for 14 days and can start relieving depressive symptoms in as few as 3 days. Manufactured by Biogen, the drug has been approved for use in the United States since late 2023 and is also authorized in the UK and the European Union. According to Health Canada's website, 1 in 5 women experience a depression or anxiety disorder during or after pregnancy. Zuranolone is a welcome drug for women suffering from moderate to severe postpartum depression, said Dr. Crystal Clark, Canada Research Chair in Reproductive Mental Health and a psychiatrist at Women's College Hospital in Toronto. Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants are often used to treat postpartum depression, but they generally don't work as quickly, and women have to stay on them for much longer, Clark said. Quote, although we have treatment options that can be effective for many who have postpartum depression, this will be the first drug that only needs to be taken for 2 weeks and has a rapid onset of a few days, end quote. SSRI antidepressants make the neurotransmitter serotonin more available to areas in the brain associated with mood. Zuranolone is a synthetic version of allopregnanolone, a metabolite of the hormone progesterone, which fluctuates with pregnancy. The drug acts on gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, receptors in the brain, which are involved in regulating mood. Hormonal changes have been linked to the onset of postpartum depression symptoms, Clark said. The medication is recommended for moderate to severe postpartum depression, with severity measured by the level of impairment in daily functioning, Clark said. Symptoms can include depressed mood or severe mood swings, severe anxiety or panic attacks, intense irritability and anger, feelings of worthlessness, shame, or guilt, difficulty bonding with the baby, and overwhelming fatigue beyond the sleep deprivation new parents normally face. Moms with postpartum depression may also have changes in appetite, trouble getting out of bed, or difficulty showering or getting dressed even when she has help with the baby. In severe cases, they may have thoughts of not wanting to live, Clark said. Many of her patients with postpartum depression are, quote, shocked that anything is wrong with them. Some of the comments I hear are, quote, I mean, I wanted this pregnancy. I'm excited about the baby. I don't know why I feel so bad, end quote, she said. In an email to the Canadian press, Health Canada said it has done a, quote, thorough review, end quote, of Biogen's evidence demonstrating, quote, that the drug meets all criteria for safety, effectiveness, and quality, and that its benefits outweigh its risk when used as intended. Part of that evidence is a clinical trial that used the Hamilton Rating Scale for depression to measure the change in symptoms in 196 women with severe postpartum depression. They were randomized to take either zuranolone or a placebo pill once a day for 14 days. There were, quote, significant improvements, end quote, in depressive symptoms among those who took the drug, the study said. The primary measurement was taken after the 2 weeks of treatment, but some women's symptoms improved as quickly as 3 days after starting the medication, it said. The researchers followed up with the study participants after 45 days and found the symptoms remained reduced. It's not known how long those effects will last or if there were any recurrences in depressive symptoms beyond that time period, Clark said, but noted that patients in the United States, quote, are doing well, end quote, with the drug. The most common side effects among study participants who took zuranolone were drowsiness, dizziness, sedation, and headache. Women should not breastfeed while taking the drug until there is more research to determine whether or not it is safe for the baby, Clark said. Because of the potential drowsiness, she said, it's a good idea for women to have someone else with them for the first couple of days to help care for the baby until they see how they react to the medication. Dr. David Silver, a gynecological psychiatrist at UPMC in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, has been prescribing zuranolone for more than a year and said it's been a, quote, very important addition, end quote, to the postpartum depression treatment arsenal because it acts quickly. Quote, when you have a woman who is immediately postpartum with a newborn to take care of, time is of the essence, end quote, he said. Silver said he looks at his patients' patterns of depression to decide whether the best treatment is an SSRI antidepressant or zuranolone. Quote, if they've had multiple episodes of depression in the past and they had depression that lasted all through their pregnancy and didn't just start in the third trimester or the postpartum, well, they may just benefit from an SSRI then, end quote, he said. Quote, on the other hand, if somebody comes in and they are not depressed through the pregnancy, and then all of a sudden in the third trimester or in the immediate postpartum, they develop these pronounced symptoms, well, that person to me is the one that I really am thinking about zuranolone for, end quote. Eric C., general manager of Biogen Canada, said he hopes the drug will be available in Canada starting in the first few months of next year. In an interview with the Canadian press, Tse said the company will be working with private insurance providers to secure coverage of Zurzuvae, which costs U.S. $16,000 for the two-week treatment. He said Biogen may, quote, eventually, end quote, negotiate with the public drug sector, and that it is establishing a, quote, patient support program, end quote, that may help some people who don't have private insurance and can't afford to pay out of pocket. Classic rock trio Triumph announced 50th anniversary tour by Cassandra Sklarsky. Canadian classic rock trio Triumph are hitting the road for a 50th anniversary tour. The Lay It On The Line rockers say next year's outing would mark their first tour in 30 years. Rick Emmett, Mike Levine, and Gil Moore say their songs are meant to bring people together, and that's why they're returning to the stage. Supported by Halifax rock pioneers April Wine, the tour is billed as an expansive 2026 North American run, celebrating 5 decades of Triumph's music, onstage theatrical flair, and legacy. They've announced 10 Canadian stops starting April 22nd in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, including Toronto, Hamilton, Halifax, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Edmonton, and Calgary. The tour crosses the border May 13th with 14 U.S. stops to date, starting in Chicago and ending in Boston on June 6th. A ticket presale for American Express cardholders runs Wednesday and Thursday, and a general on sale begins Friday on the Live Nation website. Quote, our fans have always been the heart of Triumph. Their energy, their belief, and the way they embrace the positivity in our music have carried us for 50 years, end quote, the Mississauga, Ontario formed band said in a release Tuesday. Quote, we've always said these songs were meant to bring people together, and that's exactly why we're coming back now. We knew there was still a chapter left to write. This tour is our chance to do it together with the people who made the Triumph journey possible, end quote. The band behind hits including Magic Power and Fight the Good Fight were inducted into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame in October. Earlier in June, the tribute album Magic Power, All-Star Tribute to Triumph, saw famous saw famous fans pay homage, including Sebastian Bach, Slash, Nancy Wilson, Dee Snider, Lawrence Gowan, Alex Lifeson, and Phil X. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the 10th of December issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Rachel Durkin-Durga. Thank you for listening.